Hi, Bobby here. Before we get into today's episode, I've got an exciting new show to recommend from a past guest. The Working In podcast looks at steps we can all take to keep ourselves mentally sharp. Dan Marisetta, who was on our episode about insomnia, is the host with brilliant guests including Stephen Fry, Jay Shetty and Dr. Chatterjee. I'd really encourage you all to check it out. Just search Working In wherever you get your podcasts. This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. Welcome back to Mental Podcast and the second in our two-part series all about gender as it relates to mental health. So one of the additional areas we'll be talking about with today's guest, who's particularly known for her campaigning around education, is talking about how this can affect young people when it comes to their mental health and also what they feel is expected from them as they grow up. So to set the scene for how common mental health issues can be for young people, the NHS released figures in 2018 that showed one in eight young people in England up to the age of 18 had at least one mental health disorder.
Wow. I mean, I'm not surprised, but wow.
It still feels massive though, right? As much as we've done so much campaigning for mental health education and we see stats like this all the time, you still see a different one you've not looked at before?
We also know that if that's a statistic, then how much more young people are experiencing mental ill health? If that's the stat of being diagnosed, we know that then that means there's so many more people who are undiagnosed, which is wow.
This is a never-ending challenge of mental health. The understanding is so reliant on statistics based off diagnosis. As a show that talks all about mental health stigma, we know the stigma holds a certain number of people back from even getting to the diagnosis point, even getting the help in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hoping the fact that it's new to education, you know, my children, for example, will grow up with an open mind towards mental illness.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And gender is an example where the generation coming up now are clued into it to a whole different degree. Mm-hmm. And hopefully with the mental health education that we campaign for, they're also clued into that to a whole different degree. And so it sort of all builds a greater, broader understanding. And one thing we didn't mention last time, but is a really clear example of this, is where one of the first times Juno had a panic attack when presenting at the time as a young boy, they were told, stop being such a girl. So when the first times you're having a panic attack, don't know what's going on, you're having all the physical reactions that go along with that, and the response from one of the adults that's meant to be looking after you on a school-related trip is stop being such a girl.
Wow. Yeah. You know, that's what I'm talking about.
It's one of the clearest examples I've known of these very narrow ideas of what it is to be your gender and how that can really hold people back, because, of course, you could quite easily think, well, you know, I'm letting my gender down. I'm doing it wrong. And so next time I'll try and hide this panic attack, or I'll hate myself for having one, and how much worse that can make your mental health.
And I still think there's that stereotype around people feeling more comfortable with girls who are presenting in a less feminine way, whatever that means. You know, girls who want to wear trainers and play sport, then it's still harder for males who want to behave in ways that's seen stereotypically as a girl thing to do. You know what I mean? There's still so much more, which relates back to the last conversation we had around those high levels of mental illness and you know, and suicide in men.
And one example of this came up in the European Journal of Psychotraumatology. practice saying that word a few times. And they found that the lifetime prevalence of PTSD in the States is about 10 to 12% in women versus 5 to 6% in men.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of a specific stigma that's brought out of stereotyping, you know, and I was brought up with that. And I'm sure a lot of people were, the idea that PTSD is something that primarily affects men who serve in the military, that is the definition almost of that condition. And so it wasn't until I got older and got to understand mental health better that I found out there's all sorts of trauma experiences that can cause PTSD. And in fact, it's diagnosed more in women than it is in men.
Absolutely, because I think violence is one of the key components that a lot of people have experienced who are then diagnosed with PTSD. And we know that violence towards women globally is a pandemic in itself. And therefore, it's no surprises, really, that then PTSD manifests itself in women more than it does in men.
Right. It's not to say that men don't also experience that, but certainly sexual violence in particular is so common for women. Yeah. And it's devastating even just to hear about. So, of course, experiencing it firsthand can have massive mental health implications. And I've known that. I've known that through my own relationships with women that have had that in their past, and how complex that can be to get over. You know, all the things that can trigger a PTSD or panic attack response that you may not even clearly recognize as being related to that trauma, but it could be the smallest thing that reminds them of that event.
Absolutely.
And something that I was so glad to have got to talk about with today's guest was our shared experience of eating disorders. The charity Beat Eating Disorders estimate about 25% of those affected by all kinds of eating disorders are male. And so in addition to that, we talk about not only that, but also certain conditions that can be common in different industries. And you got a great stat for us from ukmodels.co.uk, which is that 40% of fashion models suffer with an eating disorder or depression. And I'm an example of someone that has experience of both. But equally, I'm glad that we were able to have a conversation about that and sort of delve into why this might be, because I had both of those conditions going into modelling. And a lot of people don't assume that. They think, oh, the industry did this to you. Again, you know, that can come down to stereotyping as well. Certain industries we expect things from in a way that we don't in others, and maybe it's easier to draw patterns there. So one last bit of information from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in the States compared suicide rates among different occupations and found that the fashion industry ranked 7th, and it was behind the police, mechanics and factory workers. And, you know, you don't necessarily think about it. You think of the police, certainly in this country, deal with a lot of suicidality in the public as part of their work, trying to prevent suicide. You don't think about it within the forces. And again, you know, something like the fashion industry has that link that people often highlight around mental ill health. But you don't think about that with factory workers or mechanics.
Well, absolutely. And another fantastic example of that is a recent documentary by Freddie Flintoff, who is an England international cricketer. I don't know if you watched it. I did mean to text you actually when it was on, for the fact that I thought just the psychology of it, the stigma, was so interesting. I had utmost respect for him. I was also a little bit nervous because I thought you'd be a guest that Bobby, for our listeners, Bobby's always very, very particular about our guests' state of mind, perhaps, and how well they are when it comes to interviewing them for their own benefit and for the benefit of our listeners, to ensure that we're just comply with some safety around that. And it really worried me, actually, watching it, Bob, because the guy is in the middle of realising that he is living and has done for 20 years with bulimia. And it comes out in the show. And I was just thinking, I hope he's protected. I hope there are psychologists there helping him. I hope he's got some support, because he was finding all this out by talking to people and actually talking about what he was going through. And so I think sport is another prime example of where, because it's unexpected, you know, I think in the model industry, like you know, people have this expectation that one that you don't generally like, but that models generally, maybe society isn't always that surprised that a model may have an eating disorder. You know, because of what our perceptions are about what you should look like if you're a model. Within sport, though, and a man in sport who's at the height of his game to be experiencing bulimia in the severity that he did, was just as just like blown all stereotypes out of the water. And he says in that show that they had a dietitian come in, and a nutritionist, and talk to them about, you know, what they're going through, and said, you know, I've worked in other industries where, you know, we've got, well, you know, I see a lot of people with eating disorders, and I know that there's no one in the room that's going to deal with that. And he said he was literally at a point in his career where he thought, I've got to talk to somebody about this because I'm, you know, binging and purging daily. And
wow, I need to talk so to even people. The professional was and infected in by the moment, same stigma.
Absolutely. When he was about to speak to somebody, he built the courage up to talk to somebody. He went to a meeting with the whole team and a dietitian who just said that. And he said, I just went back into my box and I've stayed there for the next 10 years.
Bless him. And that is, yeah, 100% on my watch list. But it's incredible to see. And personally, for me, it's so moving. You know, I didn't have those role models growing up of seeing that men could deal with this. And that was definitely a part of the delay in me getting help or recognizing what was going on for me. And the same with Christopher Eccleston. And I guess that's maybe a summary question with these examples, right? That the modelling industry, the fashion industry more generally, has these stereotypes around mental ill health. Sport doesn't. And could that, again, be linked to gender, where fashion is stereotyped as being a female industry, sport is stereotyped often as being a male industry?
You know,
to what degree is the idea that women experience more mental health problems, that they're maybe more allowed to speak up about it?
It also diminishes that whole theory that, again, when you spend more time maybe on, you know, as a sportswoman myself, you know, what you look like has got nothing to do with how you play. You like, you turn up, you hair scrape back and just get on with it. Nobody's looking at you for what you look like, although now with social media. But that, again, hopefully goes somewhere in really kind of breaking through that mold and those theories around, you know, eating disorders are about what you look like. It's all about, you know, if you have an eating disorder, it's because you're worried about how you look. And I'm glad that these kind of things are evidence against that. Athletes generally aren't that bothered about how they look. But you know what I mean?
But yeah, it's complicated because I think there's still expectations that they have to look super athletic. You know, certain industries like boxing has a lot of eating disorders within it. And part of that relates to the fact that they have to fit specific weight categories. And so a lot of them get into the habit of dehydrating or fasting before a weigh-in as part of the sport. You know, that's how normalized it is. And so it's very easy for a lot of people to, once they've got used to doing that and they've picked up a lot of tactics, which to an outsider to the sport like me, look a lot like eating disorder symptoms, then is it any wonder some of those can bleed into their day-to-day life and they start fasting when there's not a sport reason?
Bob, you're right. And when you watch it, you'll think, I said that on the podcast. He interviews a guy who's a boxer, an ex-boxer, and who, when you see the pictures of him, when he thought he was at his height, like, amazing, look at me. The guy looks so ill, and he's talking about it now, looking back, look at me. I can't even look at myself then because I was so poorly. And then he thought, when I leave boxing, I'll leave that behind. And of course he didn't. We know that what you look like and how you present as an athlete is also important, but just in terms of society and the stigma around athletes and around models, you're not having photographs taken for a living, because if you don't look great. And he got away with this, was another thing, he was called fat, and he was called, look at the fat cricketer, and he said, but I went and won the test for England. Like, in sport, you kind of can get away with it, even though the media is so harmful, if you're winning. You know, if you're winning, then that can at least help a little bit with some of the bullshit that comes from our media around, you know, how you look when you're winning. You'll still always find ways.
Yeah, and that's it. And it's all complicated and subjective. You know, you've reminded me of the example of Lady Gaga. She received a lot of hate online after her Super Bowl performance because people thought she looked fat. And it's like, you're completely missing the point. This is such a pinnacle of pop stardom and such an achievement. And, you know, she was up there dancing solidly through her whole performance. I'm like, surely that is more important, you know, but that's where we need to evolve our idea of health. Someone that we would describe as fat can be healthier than someone we would describe as thin. It's more than just your BMI.
Yeah, absolutely.
only one of many factors. All right, so we could talk about this all day.
We could. I was going to say that. I'm having to just sit my mouth closed. I could talk for ages. But yeah, we're on a time limit.
The good news is we've got through all our stats, so we'll introduce our guest. And we're so excited to have Natasha Devon, MBE, back on the podcast. She's someone we talked to last around schools going back in part of our COVID-19 series we did at the height of the lockdown. As you will have gathered, we talked about all sorts, particularly around education, around modelling, around eating disorders. She's such a delight to speak to, so intellectual, so brilliant. What more can we say? Love, Natasha.
Yeah, she's a cool chick.
So we've been very privileged with the guests that we've got on. Thank you so much for listening to our two-part mini-series on gender. And please enjoy this interview with Natasha Devon. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Natasha Devon, and I think I had quite a progressive experience of gender from a very early age, because my mum raised me and my brothers pretty much gender neutral. And she wouldn't have framed it like that back then, but she was the second of three children. She had an older sister, and she said that her older sister always had everything pink and she had everything blue, and she wanted to be different from her sister, my aunt, who's quite kind of girly. So whereas my aunt had a Barbie doll, she had a doll called Patch who wore dungarees and had short hair. And then my mum had short hair when she was a teenager, partly because she swam and partly because she was part of the women's lib movement. And pretty much everybody thought she was a lesbian, which she was fine with. I mean, she's not, but she wasn't particularly bothered by people making that assumption. And then when it came to me and my brothers, she made a conscious effort not to impose gender stereotypes on us. So she taught my brothers, for example, to be very emotionally literate and that it's okay to cry. And with me, she's very much, you know, yes, go take over the world. There's no barriers to you doing anything. And that, I think, is incredibly apparent in the way that we have turned out. I also went to an all-girls school, and by definition, when there are no boys around, there's no such thing as a boy subject and a girl subject. If there are chairs and tables to be lifted, you do it because you're the only people that are there. Mm. So I never felt particularly defined by my gender. I knew I was quite non-conforming insofar as I was taller than all the boys in my primary school. I've always been big, broad-shouldered, tall, and not particularly into girly things when I was younger. But I never questioned that I was a girl, and it really just wasn't an issue for me until I was about 17 and I started going out.
Yeah, sorry, before we get into that, I just want to touch a little bit on what you mentioned with your mom. I find that really interesting. But I think a lot of parents might listen to that and think, well, I don't think I impose these things. I don't think I strictly regiment gender in my household with my kids. But I think your mum's a very good example of perhaps the only way to be sure that you don't do that is to actively not do it. So, you know, even right before the baby's born, you know, if you choose to know the gender and you disclose that, and then you start having a flood of colour relevant toys come through, you know, right from that point, you have to start deciding what parts of this you're going to reject.
Well, also, she taught us to question from a very early age, even when we were watching Disney films. I remember watching Sleeping Beauty and mum saying to me, now, what do you think about the fact that she's 16 and she's engaged to somebody that she's never met and she spends her whole day dusting and picking berries? Do you think that's fair? Do you think that's okay? And you have to, because the world is so incredibly gendered, you have to create some kind of counter narrative. Otherwise, children will just absorb it. And it's like Dr. Keon West, who is my co-host on the Fact or Bull podcast. he framed it beautifully when he said, you get these parents who say, I've got a girl and a boy, and the girl just loves pink sparkly things and the boy just loves trucks, and I've not done anything to influence that. That's just how children are. And he said, that's a bit like saying, I've got a child, they're six, and they only speak English. They don't speak a word of Chinese. So obviously English is just the language that children speak. It's not taking into account what they're absorbing from their environment.
Yeah, I think that's really true, that of course, we can't rule out that they genuinely just like trucks because they like trucks, in the same way a girl might just like trucks and that's all there is to it. But I see your point, and I think this is the difficulty, that so much of gender reinforcing stereotypes is very passive. And I think for a lot of people, it's this kind of intake of breath. That you see a child with toys, for example, reach for one that isn't considered assigned to their gender, whatever that means. And then there's a bit of worry there of, is this going to make things a bit more complicated for them? Or what will people at school think? There's, you know, that sort of protectiveness that's really understandable, but actually is projecting your views of gender and your experiences of it, which actually increasingly for younger generations, a lot of that doesn't apply as much.
I also think the other thing that makes my mum such a brilliant parent is she was a single parent for the first 5 years of my life. And she will quite happily say she had zero expectations of me. In fact, she's never had any expectations of me. And that's not in a bad way, as in she didn't think I was capable. It was that some people, they have this idea of who they want their children to be before they're even born. They have them working in a certain profession or looking in a certain way or doing certain activities together. And my mum's attitude was very much, well, I'm just going to see what she's like and then support her, you know, what with whatever she wants to do. And I think what's really lovely is, because I've got an MBE and I go on telly and stuff, my mum gets a lot of people coming up to her going, oh, you must be so proud of Natasha. And my mum will say, I am, of course, obviously. But I'm equally proud of Ethan and Joe, my brothers, because Joe's got a job that he loves. He works in nature. He works in a garden. And how many people can wake up every morning and say that they're going to a job that they love? And he's got his own little place and he supports himself. And he was very premature. So, you know, considering where he started and how much he struggled through school, to see him doing that and flourishing is a really big thing. And I love that she's equally proud of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really wonderful way of looking at it, particularly as an example of one of those children myself, where I have become increasingly aware as I've got older and I've gone to counselling and become more self-aware that there was a lot of expectation drawn out for me as my parents' firstborn and my parents' son. A lot of that was very tied up with career stuff and expectations. A lot of it was tied up with academia, which, as someone with dyslexia, there's a huge conflict there between me being happy just to pass English and my parents expecting much better. I think to a degree, there's elements, maybe less so, that come in with gender, where I've definitely been victim to that kind of intake of breath. As I'm someone that presents a bit more androgynously in appearance, it's almost like it's anything that sort of deviates from either how you were imagined by your parents as a grown-up or looking like you did as a kid. You know, even just dyeing my hair black was quite a big deal at the time, even though there's no obvious gender link there. But it was just, I look less like me as a kid. I look less familiar to their idea of me.
That's interesting. They expected you just to look exactly the same, but stretched.
Yeah, which I think, you know, it sounds odd, but I think if you look at it, a lot of people will have experienced that. And it's understandable. There's a nostalgia around like the baby pics, and we have it in our household where I grew up, that we have our like yearly school photos up the wall, and then it sort of gets to adulthood and I suddenly look different in every photo. And I think that conflicts with the nostalgia.
There's also, I read a brilliant Catlin Moran column recently where she was talking about the difference between a male midlife crisis and a female midlife crisis. And she was saying, because women's fertility has a shelf life, there's no opportunity for us to etch a sketch our family. So we will have children if we have children, we choose to have children. And then that's the children we've got and we have to be invested in them. And then she was saying, you know, when a woman has a midlife crisis, she gets a PhD. With a guy, because they can carry on fathering children until the minute before they die, most of them, they go, oh, I've buggered that family up. I'm going to start again with someone half my age and do it better this time. And therefore, I feel like, and I've, you know, I'm really lucky because my stepdad is an incredible man. But obviously, my biological father walking out on us when I was very young, before I could really remember, had an impact on me. But I see a lot of people who try harder to win their father's approval, because I think that there's that thing in the back of your mind of, if I don't please him, if I don't meet his expectations, he can reject me and go off and make a whole new family. That could be me reaching massively. But I definitely think that that's an element of it.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to say, right, that how much of this could be subconsciously going on for us, how much of this could be our sort of paradigm of safety without us even realizing.
Yeah.
And so for you, it sounds like you had a really great setup with your mom and you'd been raised in a way that sounds very free in terms of gender. But then there's no guarantee that the rest of the world is going to be like that. So when did that kind of conflict come in?
I just didn't think about gender. And now I appreciate as well how much my school was ahead of its time. We were learning about feminism in the early 90s when it had died a death culturally, socially. It was a tiny little corner of the library that was rarely visited in most places. And yet it was just part of how our school operated. And then the only time that I really became aware of not fitting in or really had a desire to fit in was when I started venturing out into Essex, where I grew up, going to the pub and mixing with boys who weren't my brothers, you know, who I wasn't related to. And suddenly this expectation to be glamorous and petite. And for the first time ever, my intelligence was a negative thing. And it was almost like it was treated like a party trick. So my friends that I went out with would go, oh, Natasha's really intelligent. Quick, Tash, say something intelligent. I'd be like, what are you talking about? And they'd be like, no, could quote some Shakespeare or something. And then I would. And then the boys would be like, she'd eat me for breakfast. Like, it'd be a real turnoff for them. And suddenly all the rules that I'd lived by up until that point, they no longer applied. And I no longer had any currency in this world. And it was then that really I started to have body image issues.
Wow, that's really interesting. I can definitely see that conflict, that in many ways you'd been shielded from so much of that, including at school, where obviously academia is so understandably heralded. And then you find yourself out there with the opposite sex, just assuming that that's also going to be seen as brilliant by them as well.
Yeah, and I didn't have, like I say, any currency in this environment. And it was difficult, but a necessary process, I think, to an extent. Everybody, when they leave school, they go from being a relatively big fish in a small pond and they have to establish themselves in a new hierarchy. It's just that the hierarchy that I found myself in was incredibly toxic. And it wasn't long after that that I started doing a bit of modeling and just went, you know, completely in the opposite direction. And all of my focus became about how I looked.
And was then going into modelling a way to try and redress that balance, to find this currency again in a different way?
I think it was a way of proving that I could be seen as attractive. It was a validation thing and a kind of sticking two fingers up to the women who gave me a hard time when I was younger, you know, a kind of younger teenager, and saying, I can do this too. Anything you can do, I can do better. It was very much, that was my attitude. But what I didn't realize, I didn't know anything about neuroplasticity back then, of course. And whatever you put the most effort and time into, your brain kind of grows in that direction. So I was neglecting everything that had interested me up until that point and pouring all of my time and energy into increasingly toxic ways of fitting a very narrow beauty paradigm. And my personality began to ebb away, and that became all I had to offer.
Wow. And then to what extent did you find that was then affecting your mental health?
Huge. The link between body image and mental health for anyone, but particularly for women, is massive. I think what it was is I was feeling a lot of anxiety around that time in my life for a variety of reasons anyway. And I'd been introduced into this environment where I'd been told very powerfully and quite relentlessly that if you look a certain way, your life will be good. And so I concentrated all of that anxiety and all of that anxious energy into changing my body or hating my body because it was there and it was tangible. And I thought, I mean, very early on, is it even when I had an eating disorder, I was never thin enough for the modeling industry. And very early on, I remember a casting agent saying to me, "You have got a fantastic face, but your body lets you down." And that almost became my mantra. And I got really cross with my body because for me, it was a millstone holding me back from, you know, my dreams coming true, which is ridiculous because that was never even my dream in the first place. It was such a ridiculous thought structure to have.
It's a tricky one for me as someone that is in the modeling industry now, that so often people from the external world talk about it and it really comes through in the writing that they don't actually have experience of being in the industry. And I think often that means it takes a lot of the autonomy away from models. So I definitely have met a lot of people that went into it in a way that you did. And I used to help train models at my agency. And I could often tell immediately if they were getting into this for the wrong reasons. Mm. And so I saw it time and time again where they were looking for that validation, but they didn't have any body confidence or self-belief to back it up. So that was never going to work, even if they'd had the perfect modeling career, if that even exists, and they'd got the constant like affirmation and they'd booked every job they went on a casting with, and most of the time that's not the case, there would be nothing for that to resonate with because they didn't believe themselves to have value in that way. And so a million compliments would have fallen on deaf ears.
Yeah, thank goodness for influencers, really, because certainly the types of influencers I follow, people have bought into the version of themselves that they have presented online. Now, that might be an exaggeration, it might be a fabrication, but it is indisputably them. And then you want the clothes that they wear because they're them. Whereas when I was modeling pre-social media, you might as well have just been a walking coat hanger. Like, there's a book I'm reading at the moment called Sex Robots and Vegan Meat. And one of the things that it posits is that in the future, fashion models, catwalk models, could just be really realistic human robots. Because ultimately, you are a prop in someone else's vision. You're there to show off the clothes. And even now, to this day, when I do photo shoots, the photographer will often say to me, "It's a great pose, but you look like you're trying to sell the shoes. And what I want is you. So can you be you in this picture?" Because you learn to put yourself in the background.
That's such a good point, and certainly a very good example of like the narrowest ideas of what it is to be beautiful, but also what it is to be your gender, right? And so for me, I had a sort of contrasting experience in that although I also was dealing with an eating disorder, I'd worked on my confidence a lot as a survival to get through a lot of earlier childhood. I just had to do that and really was a parentified child who was used to being fiercely independent from, you know, expectations at home and expectations in academia I was rarely living up to. And so I'd learned to fight my own corner constantly. And part of that was, you know, a building of survival confidence. And so for me, that's what kind of worries me about the kind of scapegoating of modeling. That absolutely it is narrow stereotypes, and I was encouraged to look a certain way. And I was very aware, and I'm still very aware now, that the easiest thing for me to do in terms of the world loving the sight of me would be to have short hair and only clothes that are very stereotypically male and not ever touch makeup, despite being from an industry where I was used to makeup being put on me before every shoot. It was just designed to be unspottable because I was male. Instead, I had to pretend that was really what my skin looked like. So I really agree with these concerns, but I also worry about the scapegoating of modelling, of like these poor, naive models with no autonomy go into this. They're given eating disorders by the industry, and it's not the rest of society's fault, right? It's just this area.
You're so right. And I've also seen, because beauty paradigms shift, right? They change throughout history, and the most dramatic changes you see over centuries, but you can also see it throughout the decades. You know, you go from a Twiggy to a Christy Turlington. Yeah, it's a huge shift in body type. And the way my face looks was never in fashion in the 90s, because it was a very Caucasian era. It was, you know, the era of Kate Moss was dominating everything, and that's how people wanted to look. So I actually used to be teased for being weird looking, for having big lips, and just for, I guess, being ethnically ambiguous. Now that is very much the look. And so people quite often assume I've had work done. I haven't. And if I had, I would just say I had. But I also, it's really given me an insight into what people who have had work done have to put up with, and the way the blame is placed on them. And I think, well, that's not happening in a vacuum, is it? Some, you know, it's your body, you can do whatever you like with it. I've always maintained that. I do get a little bit of like, oh, that's a shame when people make themselves look like identical to the next person. You know, when I look at the cast of TOWIE, I think, oh, that's a shame. But I'm not going to place the blame on the individuals, because obviously there must be some kind of environmental pressure that has made them take those steps. So therefore we have to look at ourselves and go, well, I'm the one who's sitting here watching TOWIE. So obviously I am in some ways playing into this pressure, which has caused that person to look like that. So I absolutely agree with you that it seems to me that, you know, particularly if you're a woman, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you don't meet the social expectation of beauty, then you get abuse. If you do, you get abuse. And if you change yourself to meet it, you also get abuse.
Yeah. And it's this constant sort of nagging. And I'm often asked, in terms of eating disorders, what are the right things to say or not say? Like, people really want me to have some easy answer of, if someone seems healthier in their recovery, what is an encouraging thing you can say about their body? Mm. And therein lies the problem. I personally believe in almost every case, it's best not to talk about their body or let them bring it up. You know, there's so many things, and particularly for eating disorders, which do more commonly affect women, but I'm an example of not just women, there's already so much pressure on that, and so many attributes of women can be overlooked because their appearance is seen as so at the forefront of importance, that actually leaving all of this aside, for confidence, for their feeling of mattering in the world, there is a million things like intelligence that could make a lot more sense to compliment, or if they're funny. If you really are drawn to say something appearance-wise, maybe compliment a choice of jewellery. You know, something that doesn't relate to body size, but relates to taste and, you know, the fact that they've clearly made an effort in how they look today.
Completely agree. And also, I always say, instead of saying, I like that dress, I'll say, I love how that dress looks on you.
Ah.
It's a really subtle thing. But I actually had a woman who I had met at an event 8 years previously say to me, I still remember the compliment you gave me when we met, which was, I'd said to her, oh, that dress looks like it was made for you. Because it did. It just completely suited her. And because I'd phrased it in that way, that had stayed with her. So that was a kind of more meaningful compliment than just going, oh, I like your dress.
Yeah, I get what you mean. But that's the thing. It's just so constant. And so much of this is automated. And that's what I really love about people like your mum, that try and remain conscious of it, because it's hard work, right? You know, we are having to think about this a bit more than people would if they didn't bother. But to me, you've kind of got to, because it's there either way. So another example in terms of like male body image pressure, generally people prefer it when I have facial hair to when I don't. And generally, I have it some of the time and I don't other times. And it's not a big plot. It's just, sometimes I want it there and sometimes I don't. But almost every time I shave it off, there's comments. Or if someone's not seen me for a while and it's, you know, grown, there's almost always comments. And so that is constant. And so I am very aware that most people prefer me with facial hair, but I do not want to live my life like that. And in a way, actually, modelling has been quite helpful for that, because I think I've had some really wonderful opportunities through modelling and I really enjoy working that industry. These people pay a lot of money to have an opinion on my appearance. And, you know, sometimes that involves cutting my hair. Often that includes putting me in certain clothes. And so actually, it's really helped my sense of autonomy to be like, you know what? These people that I'm not in a relationship with and they're not paying me, I don't know if they do get an opinion or get to pressure me into looking a certain way.
Yes. And another, I think, real benefit of studying fashion or doing something like modelling is you get to see your look as something which can be fluid. Mm-hmm. It's not fixed. My mum actually went to the London College of Fashion and she says she still remembers her first assignment was that they had to go to Liberty. I'm like, this is the best thing ever. This was work. She had to go to Liberty and look at all the different fabrics and clothes that they had, and then kind of note down five different looks and then go and find them somewhere cheaper. And then the next week they had to come in looking completely different each day. And I just think that's amazing because it teaches you that your body is there for kind of expression and creativity and experimentation. And that if you get it completely wrong, you know, if you push those fashion boundaries, nothing happens. You know, you might get a couple of odd looks, but no one dies if you go out with odd socks.
I think that's so true. And I think that's a true rebellion against this idea of there only being one type of beauty. And modelling is a very good example of that, where I am aware that I fit the stereotypical measurements that designers of clothing are taught to make clothes for first. When they're at fashion school, they are given measurements of people like me, and that is the basis the whole of the fashion industry comes off. And once you start to know that and notice it, then it, of course, is very obvious that clothing doesn't fit people in larger bodies. And there's this pressure, and then it sort of monetizes the pressure, right? Because it would be easier if we all just buy the same clothes, the fashion houses would make more money. And often certain ones only make certain sizes for that reason. They go for a particular part of the population and then expect everyone else to squish themselves into that.
I still think if aliens were observing the planet, that would be one of the things that they would say is very strange about the way that we live, that we all try and squish ourselves into the size that we think we are and then get really upset. So I have a friend who owns a boutique where the sizes are European and it's the same. Like they are the same size as a 12, but it just says 16 on the label because it's European sizing. Mm-hmm. You would not believe some of the responses that she's had, people crying, getting angry, violent on occasions, leaving really bad reviews for her, saying, I'll never go back there again. She told me I was the size 16. It's like, what if you were? You know, like it's not the worst thing in the world to be. Yeah, really odd.
But that's it. We live in a world where your size is somehow a part of your value.
Mm.
And so with your experience, what was your journey like in overcoming that?
I would say there were sort of distinct phases in my journey. So if you'd have asked me this question when I first recovered from my eating disorder, it would have been very different. I would say phase one was fat acceptance, because when I first recovered from my eating disorder, my metabolism was all over the place because I'd binged and purged and starved for so many years. So even though I was eating relatively normally, I just ballooned, absolutely ballooned. And it wasn't right for me. I now realize that I'm a big person. I'm what's called big thin, I think, in the kind of BOPO circle. So I'm a big person, but I'm not I'm not a fat person. I'm just not. It's just not right for me. And some people can be. I think my largest, I was a size 22. Some people can be a size 22 and it's right for them and they feel confident and they're fit and healthy and that's fine. But for me, it wasn't particularly right. But I did balloon and I was like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, make myself okay with this. So I really went in at the deep end in kind of fat acceptance and probably unnecessarily snarky to people who weren't fat. That I became a bit of a chip on my shoulder type person during that phase. But it was a phase that I had to go through. And then I would say the next phase of that was embracing exercise. So I had only ever exercised as part of my eating disorder as a punishment thing. And it was learning how to reconnect with my body, do it for joy, how to listen to my body. Because I think that's what people so often miss. You hear people say really stupid things like, well, you know, it's more what you eat than how much exercise you do that determines your body shape and size. But for me, exercise is what tunes you into your body. It's almost like there's a circuit. And sometimes for me, the circuit can be just whizzing around my head and I have to reconnect that circuit so that it's whizzing all around my body and then back up to my head so that my head knows what my body's doing. Very strange way to phrase it. But exercise is what allows me to do that. And in turn, that's what allows me to know when I'm genuinely hungry as opposed to bored, to know what my body's doing.
Which I think is particularly a lockdown experience for many of us.
Yeah, exactly. And to not feel any kind of guilt or shame. I am vegetarian for moral reasons, but other than that, I do not restrict myself whatsoever in what I eat because I've learned to trust my body. So that was the second phase. And then the third phase was learning to not always dress in the ways that, say, a woman's magazine would tell me were correct for my figure. So now I just wear whatever is right for my mood on the day. I used to live my life in 50s dresses because that's what most suits, in inverted commas, my body type. So it was kind of letting go of the fashion rules I'd learned, I guess, and just giving less fucks. Can I swear?
Yeah.
Giving less fucks.
I know what you mean. And that's been something that, looking back on it, I realise I've done a lot of, that I haven't always realised it at the time. But it was a way to try and keep the control that in many ways I was seeking with my own experience of anorexia. It was a reaction against a lot of pressure that I felt was insurmountable. And so it was a way to kind of control me. And as we know, so often as a young person, controlling what you eat is one of the few things you have much control over. And I realized that actually, that's one of the strange things that's come out of it that is more positive, that I would never wish a condition like that on anybody, but certainly for me personally, being used to being very focused internally on my appearance actually was quite helpful in some ways, that I cared so much less, because particularly with a condition like anorexia, you just don't believe them anyway. People can tell you that you're thin and your body's perfect and all these things all day, but it's so against your reality and the body dysmorphia I was dealing with that it was just things that people were saying because they had an objective of saying that. And, you know, there's a parallel here with what we're talking about, people having an objective, particularly like women's magazines, of this is what is right and wrong and yeah, you should follow it.
Also, I realize, of course, that dieting and eating disorders are not the same thing. But I do think that the kind of psychology of diet culture is unhelpful to people with eating disorders. And what no one ever tells you about dieting is that even if you miraculously are one of the minuscule amount of people that manages to lose weight on a diet for more than like 2 weeks or whatever the short amount of time is, you never get to enjoy it because it's that fear. That certainly for me was what informed my eating disorder, that when I got down to a weight that I thought was how I was meant to be, even though it still wasn't thin enough for the fashion industry, but it was the thinnest I'd ever been, immediately that fear set in of, what if I lose this? And so, it wouldn't have mattered what anyone around me said. The goal went from focus on weight loss to I must maintain this. And I didn't know how to maintain a weight. So maintenance became about consuming as few calories as possible. So it was just the same as before. There's never a breathe out moment in any of this.
Right. And I think all of us, irrespective of, you know, taking eating disorders out of the equation, know somebody that seems to permanently be on a diet. And I've certainly never seen that as being fun for these people. And for me personally, the thing that's missing is it's never mentioned that you can diet too much. It's only ever mentioned when it comes to mental health. But you can damage your body by not eating enough in all kinds of ways and for all kinds of reasons. And I wonder if maybe the solution is one day we get to a place where we don't just have ads that say drink responsibly at the end. They will say diet responsibly. And, you know, that reminder. Yeah.
You know, diets have a 97% failure rate. If any other industry had that failure rate, we wouldn't allow for it. And yet we live in this strange bulimic culture where on the one hand, food is fetishized and constantly advertised and it's everywhere. And then on the other hand, we're told that the natural consequences of that, of food and alcohol and, you know, particularly high sugar, high fat foods being everywhere, the natural consequences of that on our bodies are socially unacceptable. And it's therefore our job to counteract that. So all of these people are caught in this eternal cycle of putting on and losing the same 2 stone over and over and over again. And any healthcare professional will tell you that it's healthier to be consistently 2 stone overweight than to keep losing it and putting it back on.
And yet, how often do we see that make it as far as the media?
Never.
And we could get into, I'm sure, all kinds of elements of how advertising makes that so. But the next thing I want to talk to you a little bit about is education. So much gendering can exist in educational spaces. And you luckily didn't seem to experience a lot of that. But I know now that you tour around schools with your work and your advocacy for mental health, body image, all kinds of really important topics. You must see a wide, wide array of how schools are approaching gender expectations.
I do. And on the ground, I have a very particular experience, I've realised, because I generally deal with the head of pastoral care or the head of PSHE. They're the person I meet at the school. They showed me around. And then I'm seeing a classroom from full of teenagers, normally, for a finite period of time. So I come out of every school going, what a brilliant school. pretty much every school that I go into, I come out with a very high opinion of. However, the statistics paint a different picture. And what's really interesting is you can go back as far as early years education, 4 and 5 year olds. And if a boy is manifesting emotional distress, that will be labeled as a behavioral issue. So he's naughty. If a girl is manifesting distress, that will be labelled as a mental health issue. And you get to this point where you can imagine that gets magnified and magnified as you go through your childhood and your adolescence. Boys have a lower emotional vocabulary. Generally, they have less words to describe how they feel. There's certainly more stigma associated with them talking openly about it. So then with men are more likely to self-medicate, more likely to need to seek help for drug or alcohol dependency, and also more likely to die as a result of suicide. And then so then you think, because everything's presented in this kind of binary battle of the sexes type way, your natural conclusion would be, well, is it better then to be a woman? If you're going to have mental health issues, would it be better to be a woman? But the thing about being a woman is that often you're not taken seriously. So I did a campaign for International Women's Day looking at the intersection between being a woman or non-binary person and having mental health issues. And what came through consistently from the stories that were shared was this idea that women and non-binary people are drama queens, and therefore they just need to shut up and deal.
And certainly you can see a lot of these links, certainly I can quite clearly, of with men being so encouraged to man up and push their emotions down, of course, drugs and alcohol can feel like quite a natural ally to that. They have an ability to numb your emotions. And so the link is very clear, but also what that's not doing is addressing any of the underlying issues. So maybe that's the second link, that we then grow up as men, we've not developed a lot of this vocabulary, we've maybe developed a lot of unhealthy ways to cope, and that can just be silence. That's not necessarily a mental illness. It can just be hiding how you're actually feeling, which can be incredibly harmful as well. And then we are confronted with the emotions of women, and that can feel quite jarring because maybe it's less familiar to us, particularly if maybe you grew up in an all-boys school and you just weren't around as many women, and the difference in communications around emotion could then feel quite jarring to you. Or it could remind you of how you're feeling, of the very things you're trying to push down. So
and again, this is an incredibly nuanced point, which is so often missed in social media and more general media discourse, is I believe two seemingly contradictory things. I believe that men and women are fundamentally different, because if they weren't, there couldn't be transgender people. But I also believe that a lot of the way that men and women are is the result of socialization. And I do think that both of those things can be true at the same time. And the mental health interventions that we see, things like counseling, were pretty much designed with women in mind. And therefore, you know, if you have a school counselor, girls are much more likely to book an appointment with that school counselor. And what the evidence from charities like Calm, for example, shows is that for men, it's more effective if you take the help to them instead of expecting them to go to it. They have been training up people like barbers, bartenders, gym instructors in mental health first aid techniques, because they recognize that men are more likely to feel that connection where they feel comfortable, where they feel not judged, perhaps with other people who are like them. So if you place people within that environment who have the basic knowledge to be able to spot symptoms, have a useful conversation and signpost them to further help, you're bringing the help to them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And of course, that's a big part of my work around mental health education, is trying to bring that help to all children, you know, so then less of them have experiences like I did, experiences like I would argue most of my generation did, where mental health wasn't even mentioned. Then somehow people are surprised when you get to adulthood and a lot of these issues are boiling over and you don't get nowhere to turn because nobody's told you. And nobody's empowered you that these conversations are okay.
My brother reminds me a bit of Winnie the Pooh, insofar as he doesn't say a lot, but when he does speak, it's the most profound thing you've ever heard. He had some training in something like mental health first aid. It was whatever the equivalent was in his workplace. And he sent me a text saying, "Why is it that I've had to wait until I'm in my 30s to be taught the most important stuff I've ever been taught in my life?" He was like, why did I have to learn about stalagmites and stalactites at school? And I wasn't being taught this. And I thought, wow, amen. I'm not saying that stalagmites and stalactites can't be useful in certain circumstances. But it does seem, if we were redesigning the curriculum now from scratch, I think it would look very different to how it looks now.
Yeah, I agree. And I have very much worked to practice that. So yeah, that's, I guess, ultimately my point is that, of course, we raise stigma in people. We embody that in them from a young age, where we leave something so vital out of the curriculum. Mm. And so I'm just grateful that is changing. But there is equally a lot more that needs to be done. And I think gender in many ways is a frontier we really are a far way off conquering in terms of mental health. Still, so often, it's just so normalized that certain conditions are associated more with one gender or not. And that's not to say that the statistics don't back much of that up, but what it does is, by only pushing forward a narrative that this affects one group, then other people are forgotten. And that's the thing that really worries me.
And that doesn't just apply to gender either. You know, it applies just as much to race. You know, particularly we were talking about eating disorders, and a lot of Black and mixed race people fly under the radar with eating disorders anyway, because even if they're visibly underweight, Black and mixed race people have a genetic position to higher muscle density. And as we know, muscle weighs more than fat, so very unlikely to meet the BMI threshold for a diagnosis. And of course, that's not helped by, when have we ever seen a high profile media story about an eating disorder which features a person of colour? I cannot think of a single one.
No, you're absolutely right. And in the simplest way to describe that with BMI, it was not created with those people in mind. It was created to be white Eurocentric. And it doesn't even work properly for us, as your example shows with the weight restrictions around you have to be thin enough to get eating disorder support. It's crazy.
BMI is so antiquated. I really wish that doctors in particular would stop using it. In fact, I'm sure you're aware of the work of Hope Virgo,
who's also a previous guest of the podcast. So I'll include a link to her campaign on this as well.
Fantastic campaign around this, because it's an example of something that I don't know how it's survived this long, BMI, because there's so much evidence to show that it excludes huge swathes of society.
And I love with talking about gender how articulate you are on these differences, because like you say, it can feel quite contradictory at one point that so much of gender is made up and just societally reinforced. But then at the same time, there are very real differences that also can't not be acknowledged.
One of my experts that I work with is called Dr. Ben Hine, and he's a lecturer in gender at the University of West London. And I love the way that he describes it. He said, if you imagine, say you're a boy, you've got this stone of boyhood. So you're a stone at the top of a snowy hill, and the snow is society's expectations associated with being a boy or a man. And then as you begin to live your life, you are kicked down the hill. And as you roll down the hill, you pick up all this snow. So by the time you get to the bottom, you're this massive snowball of masculinity. So there was still that essential boy stone, which is who you were. But then there's all the other stuff around it, which is what our culture imposes on you.
Wow, that's a really good way of phrasing it. I might start referencing that one myself. And then in becoming so articulate about gender, I know that you've had a lot of backlash in the past.
I have. And it's because the media, particularly certain types of media, I'm aware of describing the media as though it's a monolith, but certainly the clickbaity type media, which is so prevalent, relies on you being able to summarize your point of view in a tweet or a headline. And when we're talking about big issues like gender, it's incredibly nuanced and it takes a little while to describe. And I had you can see how it gets distilled. And I had an example of this in 2017. I was speaking at the Girls Schools Association annual conference. So you've got staff from girls' schools all over the world who've come together to share best practice. And I was doing the keynote speech about mental health. And I talked about lots of aspects of mental health. For about 10 minutes, I talked about heteronormative assumption. When you look at mental health statistics, there are certain groups in our society that are more vulnerable. And the thing that they all have in common is they're less likely to feel that they belong. So you've got first-generation immigrants, particularly vulnerable, people with disabilities, LGBTQ people, all more likely to feel like they're on the fringes of society. And belonging is a really key human psychological need. So my argument was, you know, if we want to address that, we need to make efforts to ensure that people who are from other countries or Black or Asian or LGBTQ or have disabilities know that they are welcomed and safe and celebrated. And then, and this was a completely spur of the moment thing, I suddenly thought, oh, I'm at the Girls Schools Association. I'll give an example that's relevant to this audience. So I said, for example, if I came into one of your schools and I was doing an assembly, I wouldn't start that assembly by saying, hello, girls, because even though it's an all-girls school, I don't know these pupils. And there could be non-binary, gender neutral, gender fluid, transgender people in the audience. There could even be people who find the word girl patronizing. And I want to make everybody feel as welcome as possible from the outset. Now, what I don't do, obviously, is go in and go, hello, girls and non-binary and gender neutral and gender fluid people and transgender people, and because that's a really long introduction. What I say is, hello, everyone. I begin all of my talks the same way. I say, hello, everyone, because I just think that's the most inclusive way you can begin a talk. But I thought it's quite practical and they can take that away with them. Now, it took me quite a long while to explain that. and there was a journalist in the room from the Daily Mail. I mean, there were steps to how it became this. She asked to interview me afterwards, and I was, you know, trying to say that this is not an inconvenient concession we would make for the benefit of transgender people alone, that there are lots of invisible expectations and stereotypes associated with gendered language. So it's advantageous to everyone to keep gendered language to a minimum. It ended up, I was on the first four pages, I would say, of every major newspaper in the UK. And the way that they'd gone with it was, I was trying to ban the word boy and girl from schools. I'd ordered teachers that they should no longer be allowed to use these words because it was offensive to transgender people and children should not be reminded of their gender. And I was everywhere. Piers Morgan got hold of it, had a massive rant about me, said that, you know, I was everything that's wrong with modern Britain. You know, I'm the PC brigade gone mad.
Wow.
And of course, with Piers come the trolls. So I'm getting death threats. I'm getting rape threats. That was
the,
really...
irony of that, though, just if we can pause on the rape threats at these people right. that are saying that no, gender isn't a factor in the way that you're saying it is, but they're also going after you with rape threats. And I wonder if many of them would be making the same threats towards a man in your position.
There are so many things. When I say things that people disagree with, one of two things happens. Either lots of men tell me that they don't want to have sex with me, which I'm like, well, that was never on offer. Like, I don't know why we're discussing this. Or it's, well, what are your qualifications? And I'm not saying that it's not important to know what someone's qualifications are, but I've never seen a white man in a suit on TV be bombarded with tweets asking him what his qualifications are. It just doesn't happen in the same way.
Certainly something that I think links back briefly to what we were talking about with body image. Mm. That it's a really complicated conversation because body image pressures are massive on men as well, and they are also increasing. But there's certain things I just don't see, like the competence of politicians is rarely called into question because of their weight if they're male. I almost never see it. And yet with women, it's constant.
Can you imagine? This is just my opinion, but I can't think of anybody less qualified to be Prime Minister than Boris Johnson. He just seems to have none of the applicable skills. Talk's a good game, but underneath it all, I don't think he knows anything. But can you imagine if we had a woman Prime Minister with messy hair, you know, often shirt untucked, bit tubby, just going blah, 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 instead of doing a speech? Can you imagine anyone describing her as Churchillian? It just wouldn't happen. Anyway, it's a bit of a tangent. But that was 2017 when that event happened. As horrible as it was at the time, I'm actually immensely grateful for it because that was when I started to take a real interest in gender. That was when I hooked up with Dr. Ben Hine and various other experts in that field, because I realized that I had inadvertently placed myself in the center of a really contentious debate and that I had to know what I was talking about in order to survive it.
That's really fascinating, though, that you had to suddenly sort of build up your defenses, because what had started off as you just trying to include people and be nice to the students of those who had hired you at their schools, you know, like, which just seems so obvious, then became this massive issue that you were then pulled into all these other parallel issues. Because so often that's what happens, right, in modern debate, that even if you explain something perfectly well and the person can relate to it, then they just move the goalpost. So then they trip you up, and then they get you to explain something else. And then soon you find yourself on territory you can't explain as confidently, and then they're like, what are your qualifications on this? It's such
absolutely.
A trap.
Yeah, absolutely true. And it does make you think now. Every time I see one of those type of headlines, it makes me try and take a few steps back and go, what is it that this person is likely to have said? Because the likelihood is that they've said something completely reasonable.
Right. And this is the thing that baffles me, is what is the threat? Right, because it's seemingly only that people have to think about things more and maybe make a little bit more effort. You know, that is the terrifying thing that people think you're bringing to society. And actually, my counter argument to that would be, well, what is the cost? You know, if you're going into a school and you're, by trying to be inclusive, whether someone agrees with that or not, you are saying hello, everyone. Anyone that's identifying as a girl in that room is not going to forget she's a girl, is not going to get confused, is not going to have an existential crisis. They're not even going to notice.
Exactly. And I think what it is, I was having a very interesting conversation with this actually with Stephanie Yeboah, who was talking about her experience as a black fat woman. And she was saying it really hurts people to see a black fat woman being happy and successful because everything they've learned tells them that that doesn't happen. I think that's where you get the resistance, is you challenge something. It doesn't matter how toxic the idea is. If you challenge an idea that people have grown up with and internalized and they've learned, okay, this is how the world works, and as long as I abide by these rules, I'll be fine. And then they realize, well, I've spent my whole life living like this, and now somebody's trying to change it, and it makes them really fearful. Reginald D. Hunter makes a really good point about that, where he had someone say to him, oh, I hope you're not one of those comedians that goes on about race all the time. And he said, well, you're someone who can opt out of it. I would love to be able to opt out of it. You know, his joke is kind of half joke, half, oh, that really is so true that it almost hurts. He said, I'd love it if I was being wrestled to the ground by a police officer and I could just go, you do not exist. But unfortunately, this is the body I'm in every single day. And, you know, obviously as a comedian, he talks about his experiences. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's as soon as you intellectualize something, unfortunately, if you're the Vulcan in the room who is not emotionally invested, people always also think you're more right. You know, if I get emotional when I'm talking about my experiences of being a woman, for example, and then I've got a man debating me who's like, well, actually, if you look at the statistics, the pay gap doesn't really exist. People will walk away from that debate thinking that he is right because he remained logical and unemotional. And I think maybe that's something we need to address as well.
Yeah. And it's the same pressure, isn't it, that you, particularly for men, you gain authority by emotional stoicism. Mm. And then we wonder when that's so prized that then men have difficulty connecting in certain relationships or find that they come across conflicts with, you know, kissing their kid in public maybe seems a bit too soft. Like, it's, you know, it's baffling. And yet I've had those conversations with men in my life where there's been certain things where they're like, oh, do you think it looks a bit weird for a man to kiss his kid? I'm like, what? I mean, yeah. I think the bigger issue is, I think the question for me is it your kid or not? Like, that would always be the thing, right? Like, I don't really care what the gender of the adult is. If it's clearly your child, then kiss your kid.
They introduced a law in Sweden about 10 years ago now, where paternity leave became essentially compulsory, insofar as if you didn't use it, you lost it. And every man was given, I think, 6 months paid leave if he and his partner had a child. And it's interesting to see now when you go there, there are all these guys walking around with, you know, papooses and buggies on their own. And there's a very particular Scandinavian look that a lot of them have, very beardy, tattooed, like big, traditionally hyper-masculine guys, but doing active childcare without women with them. This is what I do, is part of being a man. And that was fascinating for me as a British person. It made me think about how it doesn't always work, but how laws can actually change culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And just what we think is normal. You know, it's actually so malleable that it seems like this big, unmovable feast. And certainly for those of us that want to see a lot of change, it always feels like that change comes too slow. And then you can step out of your own experience and be like, huh, this place has already solved it.
Yeah. And that place is always Scandinavia.
Yeah. Yeah, they do so well. We have gone so far off on the tangent. You were going to talk a little bit about getting more involved in conversations around gender after being pretty much dropped into it unintentionally.
Yes, I was a little naive. I mean, I have always been a trans ally insofar as I've never seen a reason not to be a trans ally. But I was very naive about the extent to which there is an agenda, not only stop them from obtaining rights, but also to roll back rights that they already have. You know, for me, it's quite simple. As a bisexual person, I can see the exact same arguments that were homophobic arguments that we used maybe 20 years ago have been recycled and are now being used towards transgender people. So it's always like, it will confuse children, think of the children. Or, you know, I remember when Section 28 was abolished, an MP saying, if a man can marry another man, then what's to stop a man from marrying his dog? And then that became, oh, if you can identify as another gender, then people will start identifying as dogs. I'm like, at least be a little bit more imaginative in your your homophobia and transphobia.
Yeah, and I can't help but hear something like that and just think to myself, you must have never met a gay person or a trans person. You know, that's just how it translates to me.
So I guess I was naive in so far as I thought, well, obviously there is still homophobia in the world, but certainly we've made so much progress in that direction. I thought transphobia won't last that long. You know, once people have got their head around the idea, we'll be well away. And of course, that has transpired not to be the case at all. And so as well as making me do my homework on gender, the other thing that happened was I became a much more active transgender ally, trying to magnify the voices of transgender people wherever possible. So there was a part of me that worried about speaking about it publicly because I'm not trans. And I had a very useful conversation about that with Paris Lees, who very sweetly, when the whole thing blew up with Piers Morgan, etc., she just gave me a call and said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. And when we talked about, you know, me sort of bringing a transgender element into the arguments that I was making, I said, I don't want to speak on your behalf. I don't want to cisplain the situation. And she said, you know what, actually, that's what we need. We need cisgender allies who get it to speak up, because otherwise it just becomes such a margin issue that people think that it's not something that the vast majority of people care about, or that it's not relevant to the rest of society. So it's kind of with, because, you know, she's queen of the transgender people in this country. So with her blessing, I kind of went ahead and have been incredibly vocal about it since.
And how has that been responded to?
I used to have a weekly column in the Times Educational Supplement, and they recommended a resource to schools, which is, in my opinion, a transphobic hate group masquerading as a transgender support group. And I tried to talk to them about it and they wouldn't talk to me about it. So I actually resigned from the magazine, which is a shame because it was an opportunity to talk to teachers every single week. You are very much, you know, my audience. But I just couldn't stay with a publication who would do that. And I got a lot of support from transgender people and their allies at that time, which really meant a lot. And I continue to get a lot of support. However, there is just as much really orchestrated backlash. But when you peel those layers away, you discover that the organizations behind it are also quite often white supremacists. They're, you know, anti-abortion, they're anti-women's rights. You know, there's so many other things that are kind of bubbling beneath the trans thing. But misinformation is being deliberately fed to the public, and this has reached the highest echelons of our media. So it just, even for me, feels like a really exhausting battle, and I don't have to live as a trans person.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And it's something that I found really baffling to see how, with more trans role models in the media, which is that part of it's really wonderful to see, but it seems to, for many people, have given a license that everyone feels they should have an opinion on the existence of trans people. They exist, they've always existed, they always will.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think people don't understand is that the idea of there being only two genders is a Christian idea. And the reason that so much of the world conformed to it is because Christian countries colonized so much of the world. So if you look at, for example, Native Americans, they in their language actually have five different words to describe five different genders. And you can see that there are kind of lost civilizations and cultures which have very different ideas about gender. And I think that's one of the things that I dislike most about social media is that somebody's got, I don't know, like GCSE biology, and they start talking to you about how your arguments are not scientific, and they do. And again, this is a very gendered thing, particularly if you're a woman, they assume that you're speaking from a place of emotion as opposed to a place of fact. And what they don't realize is that when it comes to gender, the facts that they have learned are a very oversimplified, distilled version of what's actually a very complex reality.
Yeah. And in many ways, I feel like that's quite sort of basic academia in a way, that the more intellectual you get about a subject, the more descriptive it becomes. That it's very easy to have a base level understanding. And so often we see that with mental health stigma, that we can know the statistics, we can know how big issues are, like the male suicide rate. But it's a very different thing to know that on paper and actually know what that means day to day. And so the people that are most articulate about male suicide are the ones that can describe it in great depth and with great emotion and passion, which to me is a good thing. And yet there are so many people that want to reduce that down to, but do you have a statistic for every word that you're saying? And I worry about how much of that is our education system, of everything has a right and a wrong answer that can be tested, and learning how to think creatively and question things isn't prioritized as much.
If I could stamp out one thing, it would be people mistaking correlation for causation.
Yes.
so, you know, male suicide, well, first of all, people think that male suicide is at an all-time high. It's not. It's just that we know more about it now. And then they go, and that has coincided with the resurgence of feminism. And therefore, feminism is killing men. And you go, oh, just.
Yeah.
But and the other thing is, mental health issues have increased since people have been talking about it more, and therefore you can talk yourself into mental health conditions. That's the other argument that people make that drives me to distraction.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's something that I really think about with your example there about the suicide rate, of it's actually just such erasure to decide that things are that simple, that because I'm male, I'm more likely to be at risk of suicide. That is true, but also there's so much more that goes on beyond that. Also, a lot of what support the men need. It's not just, oh, you're a man, this is a part of being a man, the end.
Well, the example I always think of, which I think is really powerful as an analogy, is there was a local authority that found that there was a correlation between children not having breakfast and behavioural problems at school, and ultimately prison. There's a massive correlation between children that go to school with no breakfast and children who grow up to then end up in prison. Now, that's like a breadcrumb, because the question that you should ask is, okay, what is going on in that child's home that means that they're not fed before school? Mm. You know, that this is clearly a very complex social issue. But what that local authority did was they went, give them breakfast, they won't end up in prison. And you just go, that's not, it'd be lovely if the solutions were that simple. Unfortunately, life's not like that.
Yeah. And of course, absolutely give the kids breakfast. But we have to look so much beyond that, you know, and that's the point. It's not enough with mental health to know the statistics and know the risks. We have to find ways to mitigate against them. And I think that seems like a good place to round up then.
Definitely.
So if anyone wants to find out more about you, where should they go online?
You can go to my website, which is natashadevon.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at _NatashaDevon.
And Natasha, if you don't already know, also has her own petition. We are all at it. And yours is all about getting mental health first aiders into workplaces. So that's, I'll include right. a link for that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.